I'm Mark Olson, and this is The Real, a podcast where culture and entertainment meet. I write about movies here at The Times, and a frequent topic of conversation among my colleagues on the entertainment staff is how tough it is for any of us to just keep up with the relentless wave of content between movies and TV. So this show is about the stuff that we're watching and how we watch it. HBO may not have known it had a hit on its hands in 2011, but the premiere of the final season of Game of Thrones shattered ratings records for the network. Viewing the series has reached a fever pitch and blown up Twitter, while fans divine clues over who will live, who will die, and who will win the Iron Throne. We ponder deep cuts and consider the series' role in the history of modern television. When was the last time we said goodbye to a show long before we had grown tired of it? Let's listen in. And this week we're going back to Westeros for a survey of the new season, the final season of the television series Game of Thrones. And so to join me in that endeavor, I have my colleagues here.
I'm Mary McNamara.
And I'm Tracy Brown.
And joining us from New York,
Meredith Blake.
Woo!
Mary, I'll start with you. You recently declared Game of Thrones to be the best show ever. Can you talk about that a little bit? Why do you feel that Game of Thrones, more than Mad Men or Breaking Bad or Hill Street Blues or the Mary Tyler Moore Show or MASH, it is the best television show ever?
Because it is the most ambitious show ever, and because it never faltered, and because the degree of difficulty in this show, there is no show that's ever compared to that. So as I said in the piece, there have been many really terrific shows, but Game of Thrones operates in a league literally by itself. And also because it was such a huge gamble and it reminded the audience, and I hope everyone who is making content for television and screen, that fantasy is amazing. And it is like a way in which that we can deal with all manner of really modern conflicts. Like, I can argue that Game of Thrones is a metaphor for global warming, or is a metaphor for, I'm sure people can say, the Trump administration, or for the divisiveness in our country. That is what is so astonishing about fantasy, is that you can tell these stories about these universal truths and they can be relevant to modern day. And as an early fan of the show, I waited with one eye half closed for it to stumble and for it to just collapse under its own weight, and it just never did. I just rewatched the whole thing from beginning to end, and I'm telling you, it just holds up. But for the most part, I enjoyed it as much as I had before.
Now, Tracy, what is your relationship to the show been? Have you also been a fan of it from day one?
I wasn't. I waited because I didn't have HBO, and I was like, oh, it looks like fun. And about right before the fourth season started, I watched all three seasons in a row until the fourth season premiere. So basically just hours of endless television. And then I was hooked and sold.
And Meredith, when did you come to the show?
I also came to it in the fourth season. That's funny. I think we probably both, or at least I felt that at that point I could no longer ignore it. Yeah. That was after the Red Wedding. And I think I thought, oh God, this is a thing that I have to watch now. And I caught up on the three seasons. And I have to say, I was kind of a snob. I was like, this is nerdy dragons and Dungeons and Dragons, whatever. This is not my bag. And then I just kind of embraced it and let it sort of wash over me. And before I knew it, I was looking at maps of Westeros online and trying to figure out where the Great Grass Sea was, and all this nerdy, got really deep into it. And I think that's the joy of the show.
Mary, do you feel like there's been some pushback against the show because it's a fantasy show, or that people do in some ways feel that it's too nerdy for them?
Early on, it was dismissed literally in the New York Times and other publications as being a sword and sorcery, like, who's going to watch this? Just a bunch of nerds, which is, first of all, ridiculous because there are a ton of nerds out there. So if you just captured the nerd audience, you would have a hit show. But again, it's like, these are people who haven't bothered to read fantasy or to actually watch fantasy. I mean, no offense, Meredith. My husband went through the same thing. He would walk by while I was watching and be like, oh my God, you're with the dragons again. And then he got totally hooked. And now after we watched the season premiere, he's just so mad that they haven't released the whole season because he just wants to see what happened next.
So Tracy, you recently did a piece yourself. You got people up to speed where you covered all of the previous seasons in about 3 minutes. And how did you find putting that project together?
I tried to start from the beginning, and it's too much. So I actually focused on the end, and I was like, who are the main players now? And I thought it was most important to follow their threads because there are so many people in the show and they all have great storylines and some have all done something significant. But I think narrowing down the key players was basically the only way to dilute anything into 3 minutes.
Is it really so complicated? What is maybe the core of the show to you?
Ultimately, it's one family that tried to be just and do the right thing, and the other family that tried another opposite. They didn't care as much, but they both did it for the sake of their family, and it's those two families clashing.
Because Meredith, as the show has sort of hooked you, what is it that you feel like you've been hooked by? What is it that you like about the show?
I wouldn't be the first person to point this out, but the characters are just so richly drawn and so complicated and interesting. And there are so very many of them that everyone finds one to root for and to also hate most passionately. For me, the female characters on the show are just really fantastic. I mean, I happen to love Cersei, who is kind of like the character that everyone loves to hate, but I think she's sort of an amazing villain slash tragic figure. Arya is also an incredible character. Her journey has been from kind of this wide-eyed little tomboy to this vicious murderer, avenger of her family. So for me, it's really about the characters. The plots, honestly, sometimes I get a little lost in them, and I think I'm probably not the only one in that. But the characters are so richly drawn that you kind of just go along with it, even when you don't know exactly what's going on, which happens.
And then how has the show changed over the years? Mary, I mean, you reviewed the show when it first premiered and you've really stuck with it over time. Has it changed or developed at all over time?
The biggest change is that it literally went from a battle of kings to a battle of queens. And you had these female characters who were key characters from the very beginning, but they were not in any kind of position of power. And most of them were being bartered and sold. Many were sexually assaulted, you know, and that brought up whole conversations about the depiction of rape on television. But they were almost all powerless. And the journey of these key characters, Cersei, Arya, Sansa, Daenerys, and even like Brienne, going from these outlier oppressed characters to being the power in was just amazing. And that it happened very organically and sort of while you weren't looking kind of thing. It's like, oh, wait, this show is going from what fantasy is often criticized for, which is very male dominated, to being sort of a celebration of women in power. Power affects them differently. And so it also turns on the head that, like, oh, if the women were ruling, everything would be cool. I mean, Cersei is horrible. And I'm sorry, Meredith, but she's just like an evil person and has been from the beginning and just is totally self-interested. And Arya is just vengeance. And you do sort of wonder how she will survive in a time of peace. So the ascension to power has come not in this kind of simplistic way, like, you know, all we need is a female president and everything will be solved. Because when you were asking what is Game of Thrones about, to me, it's about looking at the impact of power on individuals as people gain and lose power and what it means to rule and be a ruler and be an advisor. And it's like, what are your motives and what is the point of having a kingdom? Part of it was they ran out of their source material, the writers, and so they did have to sort of go out on their own. And whether it was intentional or not, whether it was a reaction to some of the criticism about the way the women were portrayed, it definitely mirrored the larger conversation that we're having right now about the role of women and about the history of assault or domestic violence. And to me, that's pretty, you know, in a show as enormous as this with so many other concerns, like 5 shooting units or whatever, for them to also kind of deftly mirror what people are talking about in this country right now. I mean, that's kind of a miracle in itself.
The showrunners on the show, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, do you get a sense that they have been aware of and responding to criticism? I read there was recently a piece in Rolling Stone about the show, and they were answering questions via email, and they specifically just did not respond to, and in fact deleted from in their return response, a question exactly about depictions of women in the show. What is your impression of how they've responded to that aspect of the show, and particularly the criticisms that they received early on?
I think they're certainly aware of it. I mean, it's hard not to be. They don't do a ton of press, but anytime Casey Bloys does a press thing at TCA, who is the head of programming at HBO, there are always questions about rape on Game of Thrones and on other shows on HBO. They're certainly aware of that conversation. I think that they would probably say that they're depicting a brutal world divided by war and conflict, and that's a reality of that universe, and that they try and do it responsibly, but it's part of the world they live in. And this is also a show that men are regularly castrated. There's terrible things that happen constantly. Rape is one of the many things that happens in this universe. And I think that's probably how they would respond to it.
Tracy, how do you feel about the way the show's kind of developed over the seasons that you've been watching? Like, do you sort of like where they've gotten to now?
I mean, I'm all down always for women reclaiming power, gaining power. And for me, it's really made me think about, is there a way to celebrate feminine forms of power, or is power always within like a masculine framework? Are they successful because they learned to play the man's game, or are they utilizing their tools?
Mary, as we're entering this final season, are you happy with the way they've sort of set the table, particularly with the first episode? What do you think is in store for this final season?
Oh my gosh. You know, I have no idea, and I'm happy not having any idea, because that's also been one of the joys of Game of Thrones. It's just when you think it's going to go one way, it goes another. When you think one storyline is the most important, then they bring in something that was just a little tertiary, and then it becomes important. I really don't want to like really guess what happens. That would make me very sad if like I actually guessed. We all had to write who did we think should win. And I thought Sansa probably would emerge victorious in some way, because she certainly has had a transformative journey into leadership, which not all of the characters have had. But that said, I do hope it ends, and I don't want to say happily, because you know that like at least 60% of the characters that you love are going to die. I mean, that's just the way the show has been.
Because especially as the show has grown in its success and the budgets have gotten bigger episode to episode, do you find that the show, does it struggle to balance the sort of like spectacle aspects and the more human sort of dramatic aspects? Or is that something that maybe the show's always been good at?
I think it's done that beautifully almost every episode. And there's a pattern to Game of Thrones. The penultimate episode of a season is usually when something huge happens. But they've done a really good job of understanding that the power of the show comes from the contrast between those huge spectacles and then the one-on-one conversations, or the really intimate conversations between two characters, between the families. That's what makes it emotionally resonant. It has gotten like rather over the top with the spectacles, but the Battle of the Bastards has to be one of the best fight scenes that's ever been shot. I know a lot of people have been, oh, they've gotten too CG, they've gotten carried away.
I thought that last season they got a little carried away with the White Walker and the ice zombie dragon. My feeling is the human drama on the show is always far more interesting to me than the supernatural element of it. End of last season, where we had, I think, two episodes where they were duking it out with the army of the dead, was a little much for me. It took me out of that human drama, literally, because they weren't human.
Because Tracy, on this first episode of the new season, there's a scene that I found very compelling for the way that it combined these two aspects of it. It's when Jon Snow and
Daenerys Targaryen,
they go on a little date with some dragons. And on the one hand, it's like this big CG spectacle scene. On the other hand, there was something very meat cute and rom-com-y about it at the same time. Like, how did you kind of find that sequence?
I am one of those people that as long as the CGI is well done, I will always be behind dragons flying through the air with someone on it, dragons blowing fire onto armies of people, whether dead or undead. There's a bit of satisfaction just seeing that large scale epic fight. So I'm very much looking forward to when the ice dragon and the living dragons inevitably collide. And for me, part of the draw of the show is still the mystery of the Night King. What does that mean? Because it has to mean something.
And can you tell me a little bit more about that? Like, what is the sort of the mythology of the Night King?
Oh, wow. Deep cut. So the Night King was created by forest sprites, essentially. They had to like sacrifice someone, and he came from humanity, and they keep laying out clues even since the beginning. And you saw it again in the season premiere with symbols that have to mean something, and the symbols echo shots of how the Night King was created, or like the first White Walker was created. So I feel like the existence of the White Walkers means something. It's some sort of, because humanity or people did this, this is why they exist. And that's like part of the puzzle.
Mary, do you have thoughts on that?
Obviously, having an army of the dead, it's like the metaphor being we create our own enemies. The enemy is us. During the premiere, there was a rather gruesome scene with a child pinioned to a wall with a sort of a pattern of dismembered limbs. It sounds so terrible when you say it out loud. It was really amazing. And it like totally echoed the opening scene of the whole show, where you had a pattern of dismembered limbs in the snow, and then a little girl had been pinioned, and then you saw the little girl become a White Walker. That was how you knew basically what this process was, that if you were killed by these White Walkers, your eyes turned blue and you became a crazy zombie. So yeah, and I want to say one thing about the CG. I mean, the dragons are freaking amazing. The idea that we can do this, you know, when Lord of the Rings came out and you were just like, oh my God, we can do this. And some of the Marvel work, it's like, oh my gosh, we can do this. But the dragons are so detailed and the sound effects are so good, like the sound of their wings and the detail of their faces. There were a lot of commentary about when Danny and John, when they kiss and the dragon gives John basically a big side eye, you know, like what? And so people are going, oh, it's a horny dragon. But I think it's that the dragons know that he's a Targaryen and they're like, what are you doing? You're kissing one of your own. I don't understand. John, in the last season, when one of the dragons comes up and lets John pet him, I really feel like Daenerys should have like
guessed.
Exactly, because there is a folklore about the dragons, which is only the Targaryens can control the dragons, and that's like their thing. When your dragon goes up and starts cuddling up to a Stark, you'd be like, wait a minute, there's something going on here. I mean, it's going to be terrible when that big revelation is made, the idea that he can ride the dragons too. And then when he got on the dragon, you would have thought she'd be like, hey, wait a minute, I thought only we could ride the dragons, right? Am I right?
I like to think it's a sex face, though. I'm just going to stick with that.
I keep going back and like, maybe she knows, maybe she's aware enough and doesn't care. Or is she going to be surprised? Because when her brother was killed, she was like, you weren't a real Targaryen because he didn't survive the fire.
Right.
So I feel like it's part of her DNA to know this. And I can't figure out if she's willfully just being ignorant because
Well, we have been reminded repeatedly throughout the series, the Targaryens married their siblings throughout history. Jaime and Cersei say that like almost every time they meet. So there is that possibility that John will be like devastated and she'll be like, what? You know, this is not a big deal. You're not even my brother. You're just my nephew.
We're going to take a brief break and we'll be right back with more Game of Thrones. Is it the last of the water cooler shows?
Hi, everyone. It's me, Lucas Peterson, LA Times food columnist. And I have a question for you. Do you like to eat? Do you go out to eat? Do you eat in restaurants? Do you eat at home? Maybe you're eating right now. Are you eating in your car? Eating on your couch? Maybe you, like me, eat literally every single day. And I think you'll be pleased to learn that the LA Times food section has relaunched both online and in print. From Mexican food to sushi to Korean-inspired tacos, the new food section will open up your mind and your mouth to new restaurants, pop-ups, and food trucks. We have excellent recipes, outstanding reviews, unbelievable local food news for you. It's all for you. At the very affordable price of 99 cents for the first 4 weeks for online access and $1.99 per week after that. Basically, we'll do literally everything we can up to and until the point of actually putting physical food into your mouth, because we can't do that, but we'd like to, but we can't. So please find our content online every day and in print on Thursdays. Please go to latimes.com/hungryla to subscribe.
And we're back. Let's go to Meredith. Do you find that the success of the show, to some extent, has to do with simply the timing of the show? At this point, it's been on so long, it sort of straddles eras. It was a pre-streaming era show, came up during the rise of recap culture, even the emergence of podcast culture. And now it's existing in a very different media sphere than when it first came out. And it has definitely hung in there. But do you think part of the success of the show, and at this point, the kind of the fervor and the deep fandom for the show, has to do with that timing of when it's just existing?
I think that's certainly a big part of it. I mean, it came out in 2011, which I think was about 3 or 4 years after Mad Men premiered. And Mad Men is the show that I would single out as the show that really ignited the kind of crazy recap culture and the intense week-to-week scrutiny of fans. And as you said, that was several years before Netflix kicked off the streaming revolution. So it was sort of halfway between those two goalposts. At the same time, I still think it would be huge if it premiered next week. But I do think the combination of kind of the media landscape of this intense interest in week-to-week watching, it really helped feed it. That is something that you lose in the streaming world. I think that if Game of Thrones were solely a streaming show, you wouldn't have that kind of collective experience of viewing it altogether. This is really one of the last shows, I think, that is a true water cooler show, even though nobody actually has water coolers anymore. But it's one of the last shows that people kind of watch together, and they make a point of watching it together because, number one, they don't want to miss what happens. But almost more importantly, they don't want to miss sharing that moment together with other people. it's not just about the spoilers. It's about being there to see what happens with your friends on Twitter and social media. So I think you're right that the timing was kind of perfect. I think if it came out next week, I think HBO would probably find a way to put it all out at once.
And Mary, how do you feel about that? Do you see this as possibly the last of its kind, that it might be, in fact, the last of this sort of monoculture water cooler shows?
I'm always hesitant to say anything is the last or over. I think it will be the last until we figure out how to address the need for communal experience of television, which is there and has been there since the very beginning. And that has been sort of disrupted by the streamers. And we will figure that out. Whether we go to an all streaming world, there will be other moments of scripted television that people experience together, because that's what we need to do. But I think it will be for a while, this kind of thing where it's on a television network, people are sitting in front of their televisions watching. It is kind of funny how quickly that we went from where everybody's tweeting every single minute about 1,100 different shows to like basically this show. There are still audiences for different shows that are engaged, but not like at the level that when Scandal hit and kicked off like the whole idea of Twitter as a communal viewing experience. But it's like a show that's one of a kind right now. Even as good as Mad Men was, as good as Breaking Bad was, as good as The Sopranos was, it's so enormous. There are so many points of entry to this show. And you can see it in how the ratings have just gone from being like, what were they, Meredith? Like, were they 10 million the first season? And now like the premiere was like
32 million or something last season. And then this week's premiere got 17 million.
Exactly. It happened organically. I don't think HBO thought this was going to be a huge hit. I know they were taken by surprise by True Blood when it became a huge hit. So as the audience increased, the budget increased, it's like, so everything happened the way it's supposed to happen, which is that here's this show, we're going to do the best we can with it. Here it is. You like it. Yes, many people like it. And then more and more people like it. And then as it goes out, it's at its peak. It's not very often that you have a show that is ending way before people are tired of it. So they've done that perfectly.
And is there something to the global aspect of the show as well, both in its success, the fact that HBO has it showing all around the world and it's doing very, very well, and even just in the show itself? It has this kind of international cast. It's shot in a number of different countries. Meredith, do you think there's something to the kind of international aspect of the show and its kind of global appeal, that that's also why it's really just a sort of an unreplicatable sensation?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Something about the nature of the show, that it's about warring clans in this fictional universe, makes it kind of universal to people from all different kinds of cultures. It's sort of kind of based on the War of the Roses, which is a British thing, but I think it translates kind of across all boundaries. It has all these international actors in it, and none of them before the show were necessarily super famous. Now they have become super famous. Films in Morocco and Croatia and Ireland and all these different places. So I think that it's appealing to people everywhere for that reason. But I think ultimately it's appealing to people because of the story that it's telling, which is about family and power and political power. And that relates to everyone. Also dragons.
Tracy, what are you going to do when Game of Thrones is over? Do you have another show that might replace it? Or are you just going to have sort of a hole in your viewing landscape?
I mean, there's so many good shows out now that I haven't seen because I've made time for Game of Thrones. So it might just be time to go back and be like, what have I not watched yet? Maybe Stranger Things.
There are the prequels to look forward to, I guess.
I know, Meredith, you actually took a trip to Northern Ireland. You went to Belfast to be at the premiere of the show there and also to visit some of the production facilities. Can you talk a little bit about your trip to Northern Ireland?
Belfast was kind of the home base of the show over the past decade. Although, as we mentioned, it filmed in various places around Europe and North Africa, Belfast was the home. Basically, all the interiors and many of the exterior locations were filmed in Belfast and Northern Ireland. So I went to sort of check out the premiere and to see kind of the impact of this massive global show on Belfast. It didn't have a very large film or TV production industry before the show came along, and now is become kind of a hub of the industry in Europe. So it was a fascinating trip. And it's a show that I think they've embraced. It's ignited these kind of cottage industries of tourism. So it was a really fascinating experience.
And are you going to be publishing more stories from your trip?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to be looking up several different aspects of it. I mean, the tourism thing is a really big deal. And everywhere you go, basically, in Belfast, which is a very small city, it's only a couple hundred thousand people. And in the kind of city center is just a couple blocks. And there's Game of Thrones tour buses everywhere and people handing out flyers. And Even once you get outside the city, you'll run into someone wearing a Game of Thrones crew jacket, and you'll randomly walk into a pub and there'll be a Game of Thrones door and or a tour bus in front of it. So you really can't escape it there.
They're going to do what they did with the Harry Potter sets. Did you see where they're going to do that?
No, it's opening up next spring. They have the touring exhibition right there now, which has been in some other cities and had a bunch of costumes and props and things. And then they're setting up a more permanent one starting next year, which, like you mentioned, is supposed to be kind of like the Harry Potter one.
Tracy, Mary had touched on this earlier. For all the dragons and the spectacle and the fun of the show on a more human scale, what is it that you enjoy about the storytelling in the show?
For me, it's about a group of siblings that were separated because something terrible happened to their father, and they're finally coming back together right now. So, like, that's the storyline I'm enjoying. They each went through various levels of horrible things and have become very different, but they're back as, like, a united front. So that's the core element, the human element that I'm rooting for.
I hadn't really thought about it being the family dynamics of the Lannisters versus the Starks. The Lannisters now are completely splintered because Tyrion's with Daenerys. Jaime just arrived in Winterfell to fight on the side, and Cersei's down in King's Landing plotting she's going to backstab everybody. So that is really kind of cool, that mirror of those two families. One is united and one is splintered.
Because, Meredith, do you find that with the fact that, you know, we've had one episode so far from the new season, I think so that means there's five to go. Is there even enough runway for them to get all the storytelling that they maybe still need to tell? Are you concerned at all that, like, some characters or storylines, like, maybe aren't going to be completely wrapped up?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a possibility in terms of the length of the runway. There are a couple episodes in the middle of the season that are going to be very long, I think almost feature length. So they've got a lot of a relatively long runway, I guess. But, you know, on a show where you have hundreds of speaking parts, that's a lot of loose threads to tie up in six episodes for sure, which probably means a lot of people will just get killed. but who knows? I think we can definitely expect some very big battle episodes. You know, all indications are that there's going to be at least two kind of huge, massive battle sequences we've never seen the likes of before. So I think that will tie up a lot of the loose ends. But yeah, I do wonder what will happen to some of the lesser characters that we've grown to love. I'm just in it for Cersei. I'm not going to lie.
No, I wanted to wrap up our talk by, Mary, you had mentioned that you're a little ambivalent about, like, who ends up on the Iron Throne as being, like, the sort of end point of the show. But I want to be sure to hear from all of you about kind of, like, what your opinions are. Tracy, no guts, no glory. Who do you want to have on the Iron Throne?
I want the Iron Throne to be shattered. I wrote about how Arya should win, because the only way for Arya to win is, and to get her ultimate revenge, is to get rid of that throne, because the throne is why her family suffered so much. So I think the only way to start anew and have that kind of hope of rejuvenation, like renewal, is to just get rid of it and kind of have a more of a blank slate.
Meredith, what are your thoughts?
Well, I'm of two minds. I mean, I would like to see Arya, because she is, other than Cersei, she's my favorite, and I think she's an amazing warrior, avenging spirit. This is going to be so lame, but I would be happy to see almost anyone on there. Cersei, I just root for her because I just really enjoy that performance, for the record. But
she would be a terrible queen. She is a terrible queen, Meredith.
She is a terrible queen, but I just really like Lena Headey's performance.
Yes.
No, but is it part of the tension of the show? It's not that she would be a terrible queen. She is a terrible person, but she could possibly be a good queen. As you were saying, Mary, one of the driving factors of the show is that, like, a good person is not necessarily a good ruler.
I think she's kind of bad at both, though, right?
Yeah. I mean, she just kills people. Like, she blew up the Septum because she was mad at maybe half dozen people in there, but those were her people that she just blew sky high. That said, she's not the only character who has done stuff like that, who has, like, sacrificed large numbers of nameless people to further their own glory. And I think that that's actually going to be interesting to see if that factors in. We have a group of people, very few of whom do not have vengeful or rageful blood on their hands. Not just the blood of, I was in this battle, I had to defend myself, but, like, I am going to kill you because I hate you and you did this terrible thing.
Now, as for myself, as a person who's not, like, deeply steeped in the show, like, watching the first episode of the new season, it seemed like they were really sort of setting things up between Daenerys and Jon Snow, and that it feels like maybe it would be one of them. But frankly, it seemed like the show was really setting up a lot for Sansa to really, like, really sort of emerge over the course of this season. Does that sound right to you?
one of the questions is how much has she learned from Cersei? And if she turns out to be like Cersei 2.0, then we're back to pretty much square one. I hope that's not the case. But Tyrion just showed up. I want him and Sansa to get together. They were married technically for a minute, but I feel like they should be married and they would be a good ruling couple because I do not see Jon and Dany making it because I think they are the agents of change. It's kind of like Winston Churchill, like the prime minister of war, but then not so much domestically.
Tracy, you talked about the kind of Stark reunion being one of the more compelling storylines of the season, but I think it's also compelling because of how much they've all changed since the beginning. I mean, there was that line in the premiere where Arya is talking about her sword and Jon asks if she's used it and she says once or twice and everybody laughs because we know that she's murdered gazillions of people. But that, I think, part of the story too, an important part, is that how much of these people changed along the way and how many people have they murdered on their trek back to Winterfell. And that's another reason why I sort of feel like Cersei gets kind of a bad rap. Daenerys burned people alive last season and she's coming to pay for it, I think. But no one, as you say, Mary, in this show has hands that are clean. And I think that's something that's going to be sorted out and reckoned with in the last couple of episodes.
Sometimes I do find myself sometimes Team Cersei because she's given up so much. That's all she has left, so that's what she gets to keep.
When I was watching it again, like I did pay attention to the prophecies because they are all coming true. And if the prophecy that she heard as a young girl is true, she will be deposed by a woman younger and more beautiful than herself. Now, I don't know if any of them are technically more beautiful than Cersei, but there are a lot of them that are younger. You got to catch up, Mark. Come on.
It'll only take like a week of your life. No big deal.
It's hard. Even I found it hard. Did you see that James Corden made one of his writers sit through the whole Game of Thrones in one day or like in one sitting?
Oh my God, no.
That's James, over 60 hours of television.
Yeah, it was hilarious. And like they filmed it. They filmed this guy sitting in a room watching Game of Thrones. And presumably he actually did it. He looked pretty ragged at the end. And it's intense, you know?
And with that, we'll wrap up this conversation now about Game of Thrones. I think we'll probably be coming back to it throughout the course of this final season as we get the ups and downs, who lives, who dies, who's born, who's not born. Thanks to all of you. Why don't you tell everybody where they can find you online? Mary, where can people find your work?
On Twitter, it's MaryMacTV.
Tracy?
Frank, find me on Twitter on Tracy C. Brown.
And Meredith?
At Meredith Blake.
And I'm at Indie Focus. And so for LA Times Studios and The Real, I'm Mark Olson. This week's show was produced by Katie Cooper and edited by Mike Heflin.